We've had tone-deaf comments from the Prime Minister, attempts to recognise the sufferings of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians with a minute's silence, dismissed as playing negative politics with our history, and the absolutely extraordinary decision to award Margaret Court with the nation's highest honour. This is the same Margaret Court, I would remind you, that was a great supporter of apartheid. But ultimately, what the debates around our so-called National Day reveal is just how deeply divided we remain as a nation and how long the walk to achieve anything resembling reconciliation still is. So it's marvellous to be joined by Marcia, who has worked tirelessly to move us further down the road. Professor Langton is Foundation Chair in Australian Indigenous Studies at the University of Melbourne. She was promoted to Officer of the Order of Australia in last year's gongs, and for over a year now she's been working with former Australian Race Discrimination Commissioner Professor Tom Calmer to lead the government's Indigenous Voice co-design process. Now, earlier this year, their interim report proposing models for an Indigenous Voice department was released to the public, and while there's more work to be done, the hope is that it can bring us closer to achieving one of the key aspirations of the Uluru Statement, the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. Marcia, welcome back.
Thank you, Philip.
Marcia, tell me how you approach January the 26th with, I guess, a lot of mixed emotions.
I usually go into hiding. In fact, tonight I'll drive out bush and go into hiding again. I don't want to have anything to do with it.
You've never celebrated, have you, because you say it's, you know, we're just two or three generations away from a genocide.
Yes, that's correct. And as I remember, I was on that committee with you at one stage, and you'll remember that there were calls for a reenactment of what happened. And this is when they all wanted to dress up, you know, like convict girls and boys. And I said, sure, do that, but can we have the guns this time, please? And I think everybody around the table was absolutely horrified. You know, I've never taken it seriously. You know, Australia Day, as it's celebrated today, was only set up in 1994. And you and I were both middle-aged when it transpired that Australia Day would be January 26. So, you know, these people who say it's a tradition are talking through their arses.
And you make the point, it's not just Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians, but young people generally who are in effect insulted by what is a perversion of history.
Well, it's not history, is it? It's jingoistic mythologizing. It's colonial mythologizing. I mean, you know, it should be insulting to all Australians. It should be insulting to everybody that our Prime Minister could say that when the 12 ships landed in Sydney, it wasn't a very flash day for them either. So some friends of mine looked up how many people died on the first fleet, in which there were 11 ships, not 12. 48 people died. The arrival of the first fleet led to, my understanding, the deaths of over a million Indigenous people over, you know, more than 100 years. But, you know, the scale of the deaths of Indigenous people cannot be compared to the 48 deaths on the First Fleet. When you hear your own Prime Minister saying there were 12 ships in the First Fleet, and I thought we, you know, everybody still weren't in school, that there were 11 ships. And then, moreover...
Oh, no, be fair. He has, in fact, discovered another one, Marcia.
Yeah, well, you know, that one is the replica that is circumnavigating Australia. And, of course, as we all know, Arthur Phillip did not circumnavigate Australia. It was actually Matthew Flinders and Bungary. It's not history, Philip. It's not history. And all Australians should be embarrassed, ashamed, insulted. It's actually become Monty Python-esque, don't you think?
In lieu of changing the date, is there any merit in proposals like the one that Zali Steggall, the independent MP, put forward this year for us to observe a minute's silence? You're about to observe a minute's silence, I can hear.
Yeah, well, Philip, I just don't want to engage with anything that legitimates this ridiculous idea that Australia originated, as a nation originated, with the landing of 11 ships from England with the military and convicts. Modern Australia was born on January 1, 1901, when our constitution became effective. If Australia Day is a celebration of Australia, then it begins on 1st of January 1901, not in 1788.
I must say that's the most popular response to the tweets I mentioned earlier, that if you have to have a day at all, that's the day it ought to be. But let's go back to where you and I left off in our last conversation last year, and that's your work on the Indigenous Voice to Parliament. And let's remember how we ended up with this co-design process after the Uluru Statement and how it works. Can you take us through that?
I'm absolutely thrilled with the report that we've submitted to the Minister. We submitted it last October. 52 people participated in designing a system of representation, at the heart of which is local and regional decision-making groups, which would nominate or elect two people from each state and territory to form a national voice. And we adopted, in very large part, all of the recommendations and cautions in the Joint Select Committee that was led by, I think, Patrick Dodson and Julian Lisa. In any case, they were certainly on the Joint Select Committee. They took evidence from many people. And, of course, the main point that they make is that the Uluru Statement from the Heart, which calls for a voice to Parliament or constitutional recognition or reform, will never be achieved unless a majority of Australians agree with the proposition. And they also argued that there should be more detail. Australians would want to know what this voice would look like, how it would work, what are they voting for. No Australian would go to the polling booth without and submit a vote without understanding what they're voting for. And so we were tasked by Minister Wyatt at the end of 2019 with this job. He nominated a few people and then he largely left it to us to populate the three committees, the Senior Advisory Group, the National Co-Design Group and the Local and Regional Co-Design Group. And all of us nominated people and it became like a kind of a voting system. And if people accepted, then that was good. If people didn't accept the invitation to join us, then we started again and went down the lists. So we ended up with 52 people and we held over 70 meetings. And the local and regional decision-making group has devised a set of principles which are based on a very deep knowledge of decades of history in relation to the representation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to governments. And so, for instance, one of their principles is the principle of inclusion. Our recommendations very strongly assert that there should be gender equity. We also want to make sure that people with disabilities are properly represented, also the LGBTI community and youth. And so we've made recommendations in relation to all of those. We have left some questions open, and now that the Cabinet's released the report, we're taking the report to consultation. We're already in the consultation phase. There is a questionnaire online. People can, you know, answer a survey. They can submit a written submission by March 31. Our consultations will continue, but we need time to read the submissions. And so submissions close, or the opportunity to make a submission closes on March 31. But we'll keep consulting.
Marcia, forgive me interrupting, but the report seems silent on the question of constitutional enshrinement.
Yeah, well, that's right, because it wasn't in our terms of reference. In fact, it was quite deliberately excluded and explicitly excluded from our terms of reference. So in line with the Joint Select Committee recommendations, what the minister wanted us to do was to design the voice to government so that the government could hear what Australians think about a jointly designed voice to government and then consider the question of constitutional enshrinement later.
There's nothing in the proposals to stop constitutional enshrinement from happening, isn't it? It leaves a door open to a referendum.
Yes, well, that's right. And I think a large majority of the 52 people who co-designed this voice perfectly well understand that whatever we design will be, even if it is legislated, will be a fragile creature subject to the whims of governments. And most people, therefore, do want constitutional enshrinement because we don't want a repeat of, you know, what has happened over many, many decades, and that is every national representative body has been abolished as a new government comes into power. So, you know, we've become a political football. We're kicked up and down the field like a football. So Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people want stability. We want a system that we know has the confidence of all Australians, and that's the point of the of our report in following the Joint Select Committee. If Australians are to vote on anything at all or to agree with anything at all, then we have to provide a proposition that most people can agree with. And I don't think that anybody, apart from a few cray-crays over at Quadrant, could possibly disagree with what we've proposed.
The issue, of course, that had Turnbull running for cover is the power of the voice to Parliament. Will this be a voice to Parliament or just a voice to government?
Well, you see, it was pointed out several times during our meetings that the dividing line between government and Parliament is a very flimsy one. So, you know, once you're in the policy cycle, you know, you could very well be talking not just to civil servants, but also to ministerial staff and ministers. That's unavoidable. That's how our system of government works. I don't think we paid much attention to the imaginary line between government and Parliament. Of course, you know, there is a separation of powers. We recognise that. But in the day-to-day work of designing and legislating and implementing policy, the lines of responsibility are very fuzzy. Nothing happens without, you know, civil society, public servants, and ministers of the Crown engaging with each other. Although of late, of course, we've seen some rather authoritarian policy making. But for policy to survive and be, you know, to be sustainable in the long term, then, you know, people have to have confidence in those policies.
Is it a problem that the national voice wouldn't be able to veto laws or overturn government decisions?
No, not at all. The Constitution, our Constitution does not allow anybody to veto Parliament. Our system was created so that we have a House of Representatives and a Senate, and not even the High Court can veto Parliament, and likewise, Parliament can't veto the High Court. The Parliament can make laws and the High Court must, show respect for those laws.
Well, the Uluru Statement stressed the importance of respecting parliamentary sovereignty, didn't it?
It did indeed, and that's what I'm talking about. Parliamentary sovereignty is, you know, at the heart of our governmental system. And so there is no veto. Nobody has a veto over Parliament. So why would we recommend that we have a veto over Parliament?
I raised it because that has been a criticism in some quarters. Now, the voice can't obstruct or delay the workings of Parliament or the government. The report makes clear that the voice will not be a third chamber of Parliament.
Correct, that's right. And we recommend that the voice gives the government advice, and the government can formally ask the voice for advice, so that, you know, it's a reciprocal arrangement. And we're very, very clear about those recommendations, and I really hope that people look at those recommendations and give us feedback on them. I don't want to see hundreds of recommendations saying to us that there should be constitutional enshrinement. That's all set out in other reports. Our terms of reference, please read our terms of reference. We were asked to design the voice to government. The constitutional enshrinement question is a separate question, and I hope that people will respond to what we have recommended. I particularly hope that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who grapple with policy issues every day, be it, you know, provision of water in their communities or ranger programs or, you know, carbon abatement programs, will have a look at this and say, I tweak this, I do that, it suits us. We've left some questions open precisely because we want to see what people have to say, accommodate all of the reasonable and constructive submissions made, and make a final report to the minister.
You were reminding me that we're both getting on a bit, so we can think back about the pitfalls that brought down other national bodies. And I'm thinking, of course, of ATSIC, which was the peak national Indigenous body from 1990 to when it was disbanded in 2005. You're trying to avoid the pitfalls that cause that sort of problem.
Correct. One of the things we've recommended is for there to be an ethics body which would supervise the checking of the backgrounds of all candidates, so that and you know, respond to questions, complaints and so on, in order that the standing of all of the candidates in the national and local and regional bodies that we've recommended are people of good standing.
And you also avoid potential problems because the National Voice would not administer programs as ATSIC did.
That's right. The problem with ATSIC was that while its representative system, especially in the early part of its history, when Lorcher was the chair, was that the ATSIC was given an enormous responsibility of providing funding for programs to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We are saying no, the voice that we've designed will have no funding responsibilities and none of the program responsibilities that ATSIC had.
I can almost hear Lo Witcher, I remember her vividly telling me about the terrible problems she was having with ATSIC's commissioners. But she would have welcomed that idea of the ethics committee, wouldn't she?
Very much. And, you know, it's a great shame that that was not implemented by ATSIC back then. And, you know, the kinds of reforms that we're recommending now are very much informed by, you know, years of history in this regard. And it's not just ATSIC either. There have been bodies in states and territories and bodies that preceded ATSIC that have all been abolished, that didn't work for some reason, or, you know, there was some other circumstance, a change of government. So we are very clear that this body would not be a funding body. It would have no responsibility for programs. And, of course, what resulted from ATSIC being a funding body was two things. One, eventually, much of its funding for particular programs was taken away and returned to government responsibility. So you'll remember that responsibility for health funding was taken off ATSIC and returned to the health department because it is simply too big and too complicated.
Any chance of seeing an Indigenous voice pass Parliament before the next election?
Well, it's my hope that this will happen. The COVID-19 virus remains controlled and we're able to complete our consultations and our report, and therefore the legislation for what eventuates from our consultations is legislated in this term of government.
Well, you've used that term, aspiration. Ken Wyatt has said that it's his aspiration, and of course Shadow Minister Linda Burney wants any legislation to include a time frame, doesn't she, for moving on to constitutional recognition?
Yeah, well, Jenny Macklin tried that. You'll remember that she legislated and put a sunset clause into legislation for considering this question. Of course, Parliament's free to do that. Circumstances are a way of deflating our aspirations. I hope that's not the case. There are good questions to be asked. How will this be funded? When will all of this happen? I hope Australians address that in their submissions. I hope particularly that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people address these matters in their submissions.
You've been fighting these battles for decades, Marcia. There must have been many times when you felt like chucking it all in, but I sense now that you've got a resurgence of hope.
Well, Philip, the only way to overcome the terrible disadvantages that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people suffer across all indicators, from health to social to economic, is to involve Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in decision making that affects their lives from the very local level to the national level. The top-down approach of imposing solutions on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people has not only failed, it has made the situation much, much worse, and it worsens every year.
Marcia, thanks for your time. Great to talk. Marcia Langton, Foundation Chair in Australian Indigenous Studies at the University of Melbourne and co-chair of the Senior Advisory Group leading this Government Indigenous Voice co-design process.